quite shocked when he landed there. That team were not updated in the 1980s, and we don't understand why that. I mean, and it doesn't make sense. And we're hoping that National Treasury is also going to be able to assist us in shedding some light on this, and I'm hoping that the members will be making resolutions to that effect so that we can now begin to monitor this aspect that is very serious. And members, without further ado, could I kindly ask Mr. M. Dipofo to make his presentation? Is he here? Oh, okay. The DG is not here, so are you going to be making the presentation, sir?
Yes.
If you could introduce yourself.
Thank you very much.
And then you can, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I am Walter Mudau, coming from the DPSA. I'm the acting DDG in the space of Government Chief Information Office. And thank you, honorable members, and for the opportunity to come and discuss the issue of e-governance. E-governance here meaning the...
Just hold on a second. I just wanted to get clarity. Do we have the Chief Information Officer currently?
No, I'm currently acting on the space.
You are acting in that position, which means that it's vacant.
Yes.
No, I wanted you to make sure that that was the understanding. It's not that he is not here for one reason or the other. It has a bearing on how we resolve on this matter. And that is why I wanted us to clarify that. But you may proceed, sir.
Thank you. So the issue of corporate governance of ICT, or the lack of control in terms of who procures IT, who makes decisions, I think is the one that is the AG has always been highlighting as the cause of failure across the government. So in order to deal with that, I think the DPSA came with a framework that departments could use to make use of to control the use of ICT across government. There is a presentation that has been distributed, and I had this on the... I'm not sure if there's somebody who could be playing it around there. Okay. The introduction is that departments nationally and provincially are heavily reliant on electronic information systems to perform their duties as per their respective mandate, and also for the reporting purposes and administrative purposes, which means then we have got two levels, one level being the internal processes and the other one being for service delivery. Now these information systems, they enable the automation of business processes and the transaction processing, which contributes to the effective service delivery. And information stored in these systems are considered a strategic asset. Now the e-governance is the implementation through a corporate governance of ICT policy framework in order to make sure that the general ICT weaknesses that have been identified by the AG are dealt with. Some of this is financial management weaknesses, inaccurate financial and performance information, fruitless and wasteful expenditures including fraud, poor performance of the entity, and non-compliance with applicable laws and regulations. And some of the weaknesses that were also identified in terms of the e-governance space in the ICT environment were that heads of departments are not taking responsibility for the deployment of ICTs. You find that whatever the vendor might be coming in to sell to the department is bought without thinking of the strategic input to the department. There's no clear ownership of IT, no roles and responsibilities, lack of structures, policies and procedures on how to acquire and dispose of ICT, and not sufficient ICT capacity and competence within departments, and lack of independent measurement and monitoring of the controls within the departments. So in 2012, in collaboration with the IT managers of the whole departments and the AG, where the DPSA developed what is called the Corporate Governance of ICT Policy Framework. When a cabinet adopted this framework in 2012, they expanded the scope instead of it being applicable to provincial and national departments. They said the scope should go to all institutions as defined in the Section 125 of the Constitution and all organs of state and public entities. And out of that, the MPSA issued the implementation guideline to assist departments in implementing this policy framework and the assessment standards that the departments should use to assess themselves that will then be used by the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation to assess if there is progress in terms of the controls of the ICT. And then this framework established an accountability framework for the strategic leadership of a department. And the implementation approach that was adopted for the use of this framework was to say that it will be applied in phases. Phase one was started in 2014, such that the departments will be creating an enabling environment. And then phase two, which started in March 2015, made sure that the business and the ICT strategic alignment is achieved. And the phase three onwards was the continuous improvement through an iterative process that we went through. And it is the responsibility of the DPSA to support all these institutions in their respective environments. And we need to create awareness from executive level up to ICT management level. We need to maintain the prescriptive environment on e-governance and develop and deploy guidelines that would enable to support the implementation of this policy and advise on the public administration institutions on how to implement this. We also need to provide expertise on the framework. We'll provide advice on the business and ICT alignments, provide assistance on the ICT planning and all related things that are prescribed in the public service regulations. So far, we have conducted awareness training to more than 2,000 people from national departments to other institutions like your Road Accident Fund, CETA, and National Risk Management Forum. It is the implementation of this governance framework is monitored by DPME through the MPED process. And the areas that are assessed through this MPED process include, amongst others, the implementation of departmental policy frameworks, which must be aligned with the government-wide policy framework, explaining the corporate governance system, principles and practices to the departmental executives, development of a charter that explains the accountability structures, roles and responsibilities, and development of ICT plans, implementation plan and operational plans as per public service regulations requirements. According to the results of the MPED systems, compliance across government has increased from an average maturity level of 1.3 in 2013 to 3 by 2016. There are still other departments and provinces that are still performing below the desirable level of 3 as a maturity level. There is a slide, I don't think it will be, members will be able to see that, but that shows the improvement that has been taking place from 2013 onwards. Then the AG, who were the first to identify that there's a lack of control across government, also did an assessment across the 433 national and provincial departments, and they assessed that those that departments that are classified as being in a good area have increased significantly from 13% in 2013 to 29% in 2015-2016. And the audits that required intervention declined from 21% in 2013-14 to 16% right now, which means that there has been a traction, but I don't think it is sufficient enough. At 55%, the audits that are all of concern still needs attention, thus leaving around 71% of the audits needing attention. The AXA information has also been supplied. I'm not sure if members could be able to depict that, but there is slight progress that is taking place in terms of the progress in the implementation of the corporate governance. The challenges that we might be able to highlight so far to the members here would be to say that most departments have adopted the framework, but they have not customized it to their own environment, because it cannot be a one-size-fits-all. Everyone department has to use it for to adopt it to their own environment. The chief information officers, or the GITOs as they are called in government, and the ICT managers and ICT staff did not fulfill their responsibilities by ensuring compliance with the controls established to secure and regulate their department's ICT environment, sometimes due to lack of consequence management. Because the chief information officers or the IT managers are the ones that are called the governance champions. They are the ones who need to drive this process. So usually, if there's no consequence for non-compliance to the governance framework, it results in people not just neglecting their work. And then lastly, the accounting officers and accounting authorities do not prioritize the approval of ICT policies and procedures to ensure that proper internal controls exist. Because we might be having proper controls, but if they are not properly signed by the governance structure within a department, then they become ineffective. And with that, thank you, members.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm not sure members
would like to engage on this particular presentation now, or you would rather that we go to CITSA first before we could engage CITSA and National Treasury. Maybe let's get the holistic picture. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Is CITSA ready? Thank you very much, sir. We will be engaging with you once we have taken all the presentations. Dr. S. Moabi.
Honorable Chairperson and honorable members, thank you very much. I am the first time in this committee, and I come here under the leadership of the chairperson of the board, Mr. Nambeta.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you. And also with one of our colleagues. Our presentation will deal with our efforts and the state at which we are modernizing our the government IT infrastructure, and also which includes also the application environment, the software application environment, noting that indeed that we confirm that some of this application and some of this infrastructure is quite old, but we hope that we'll be able to give the committee a comfort that we have turned a corner and that we are dealing with these matters in a practical way, at a practical level. The first part, there are two presentations. The first one deals with infrastructure, and the second one deals with the applications. Going on to page 2 of the presentation, we have always had 5 key areas of or 6 key areas, I must say, of the strategy of CITSA. First one aligned with our core mandate. The first one dealing with our role as a procurement enabling for supply of goods, ICT goods and services to government. And the second one dealing with the core IT services. And then the third one specifically dealing with the digitization of the public sector through IT. And then the fourth one dealing with the securing government IT assets, including the data that sits within the system. I think quite importantly, the other one dealing with the human resources and the skills base. And I hope that the members will appreciate the context under which we are raising that issue about skills, not only within CETA, not only in the departments as the DPSA has just mentioned now, but also in general.
No, we are just talking about the board chair. We think it's sitting in an awkward position there. We prefer to see him.
Thank you.
We don't want to be idle. We need to take ownership of the decisions that are taking place there. We're not really engaged. We want to know your voice.
Thank you, Chairperson. Before we go to the next page, we thought to maybe just to remind ourselves around the evolution of the mandate of CETA, and I'd like to just point out two areas relating to the CETA Act. The first version of the CETA Act said that the role of CETA is to be an IT operations or to provide IT operations to government. And in a sense, the metrics of performance metrics there would have been on the extent to which IT systems are available, in which on the basis of which IT systems, so there would be technical metrics of performance. The CETA Act was then amended in and around 2002, where now the first object of CETA is to improve service delivery to the public through the use of IT. Because then that changes the performance metrics. Because now we measure ourselves, or we should measure ourselves under the amended Act on the extent to which we have improved our various elements of service delivery, be it in education, be it in health, and so on and so forth, as Chairperson mentioned now, be it in security. So what we are doing now, and I must say that as when the mandate changed, we probably did not change the internals of CETA as appropriate. We kept becoming an IT operations, and when we could have included even more of a capability to align better with the business of government and change our performance metrics. So what you are doing now is presenting a modernization program that allows us then to implement and to implement our job in the context of the mandate that changed in 2002. So if we go then to page 3, it looks like a complicated diagram. But if Chairperson will allow me just to spend a little bit more time there. And I will explain the IT artifacts that are demonstrated there.
Okay.
Yes. The first one is that
I just want to make sure that the members have the correct presentation.
Is it?
Yeah,
yes. So the first presentation is titled Modernization of Infrastructure and Services.
Oh, it's not the one on the application?
No. Yeah, that will be the second part.
Okay. No, that's
fine. So, like everything else in life, IT is supposed to help us to conduct our lives better, whether it's in the home or whether it's in our business lives, and certainly that also applies to the business of government. And when we say modernization of IT, we have to understand what government is trying to do and what government is supposed to deliver to the different objects that it deals with. And if we say improve service delivery to the public, then we have to look at what is a promise of performance by government to the different objects that government deals with. So for example, and we look at that not only in the context of a particular state of life. So for example, we can say, has the life of a child improved? If you look at the life of a child, are you fine?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. So one can say, take the lives of children between birth and age 6, just before they go into basic education. Is there an improvement in the lives of that cohort in between today, in 2017, versus in 2007, versus in 1997, for example? So that is a state of life. And then you say that, fine, take a child as they go through life. Is there an improvement in the quality and prospects of that child through their lifetime? So we look at both the service improvement in service delivery at a point in time of an object and through its lifetime. But the people, citizens, are not the only items that government is concerned with. Government is concerned with the environment. Government is concerned with the use of land and the effectiveness in the use of land. Government is concerned with the effectiveness of businesses, and all of these things have life cycles. Businesses have life cycles because they are ideas, they become small businesses, they become medium businesses, and become large businesses that trade internationally. All of these things are of concern to government. So IT systems must be able to respond to performance challenges on all of these objects. If we, as CETA, do not understand these performance challenges, then we'll never be able to provide IT systems that truly improve service delivery to the public. So that's the first line on our diagram there, understanding the context under which, through which government interacts with society and with the economy. The second thing then is understanding how the different objects, citizens, businesses, the environment, interact with government. To what extent? I mean, let's say, for example, measurement of the environment, or even the ocean fisheries. How do we measure the health of that environment? What systems do we use to measure that? How do we then store that information? And how does that information interact with other information that government collects in other places then? So we have to look at the efficiency of the interaction between government and its object. For example, many times we go to government department, and when we interact with the public servant in front of us, we interact through a piece of paper. And the piece of paper passes, and we will sometimes wonder, what happens to that form that we just filled in there? How does it end up being in an IT system such that when we visit another government department, we find that information ready, we find it accurate, and we find it in context? Right, so we have to wonder. I mean, that's part of the digitization of the government interface there. The next level is, on three there, is the applications themselves. The public servant that is sitting in front of us, there is a computer in front of them there. What application is sitting there? To what extent is that application able to deal with the changing context of life? That application would have been okay in, for example, in education, when we are registering learners for courses, when we are registering them for exams. That application would have been okay in 1989, 1991, in the context of life then. But that application is no longer, if we don't change it, it's no longer applicable right now, because life has changed, curriculum has changed, and so many things have changed around it. So it must be as dynamic as the world around us. Then we come to data. Similarly, the interrelation between data objects becomes different. For example, when somebody, unfortunately, let's say, gets into the correctional services environment and they go through rehabilitation, the government knows that person because that person was in the basic education system at some point. That person was in the social services system at some point. That person was in the public health system at some point. If we knew and we combined all of that information, then perhaps we can provide better rehabilitation program for that particular person, so that we reduce the likelihood of that person coming back into that correctional service. So integrating data within government becomes another area of concern. So our modernization program, Chairperson, is based on proper understanding of the business of government between departments, business of government through understanding the life cycle of the objects, and then modernizing then the interface, the public interface, modernizing the applications, modernizing the data, and then the rest of the infrastructure. And once we do that, we also now can put in our technical hats on and say, how do we fundamentally change the value proposition that CETA provides to departments, that the departments of government through the departments provide to citizens and businesses and so on and so forth? How do we fundamentally change the cost structure of the provision of our public services, certainly the provision of IT services? How do we fundamentally change the agility and flexibility of the IT infrastructure to be able to deal with the changes in the in the world around us, and so on and so forth? And then how do we also provide the security and the resilience of the IT infrastructure such that when we have a ransomware kind of scare, we can come here and say with certainty that the IT system, the government IT assets, the data, is indeed secure. And lastly, how do we ensure that we are not that we develop and the skill space generally in society and certainly in the public service in order to make sure that we are no longer in a situation where we are running applications that sit with us for 30 years and that do not support the dynamism in society. Moving on to page 4, we then summarize the different building blocks, and I'll just give examples of those. We're saying that the modernization program has to do with the government business applications, as Mr. Mdawe just said. Those are applications that drive public service directly. And then the second part is modernizing the applications that allow government to manage its resources, whether it's financial resources or human resources. And IFMS, for example, fits in that space. And then the last part is applications that allow us to work together in an efficient way or effective way. For example, basic things like emails or communication systems. And then do so in a way that guarantees security and also that guarantees the continuity of the government, business of government. One of the audit findings, for example, that have been there over the years has been on disaster recovery. And then, that is on page 4. And then going on page 5, we then summarize our programs into three broad areas. The first one is e-government, which is implementation of the governance framework, implementation of the e-government strategies that the department, for example, of telecommunications and postal services has just released, and towards modernization of the applications and infrastructure. The second one is now specifically looking at the IT infrastructure and seeing how we modernize that so that we fundamentally reduce the flexibility and the cost base. And then lastly, look at the networks that support or link up government offices and the IT assets. Won't say much about on page 6 about the network. The guiding principle or policy instrument there is the SA Connect policy, and we can have a special session about that. I think the concern of the committee, from our understanding, was on the aging infrastructure portfolio and the applications. Then going on to page 7, we start with the infrastructure. We're introducing a term there called cloud, which members would have probably come across. Essentially, a cloud paradigm is a paradigm that reduces, that enforces consolidation, and we'll explain now, that removes the current silo way of building and maintaining infrastructure, that guarantees fundamental changes in the cost of acquisition of IT infrastructure and the cost of maintenance and operations of that infrastructure. That provides the agility and flexibility to government departments. That allows us and says that I will only use IT and pay for IT infrastructure for what I'm using, not buy and hope that I will later on use it in the future. And in the meantime, I'm paying for something that I'm not using right now. So we are using that paradigm. It is it's being applied everywhere, and we are using that paradigm to modernize the basic infrastructure. And we provide some examples of the what that means to government departments, and then what that means to how CETA then, the basic value proposition of CETA. And that comes on page 8. On page 8, the two blocks that are on the bottom right corner, Chairperson. The first part shows how we are operating right now. Every department will buy its own system, its own hardware, will install its own software, will buy independently from the software providers, and will have its own service level agreement with the software providers, and will probably sometimes buy in anticipation of growth, let's say, of public service. And in the meantime, we are paying for excess capacity. And we will never know what the other department is buying. In fact, we've just done an exercise right now with one of the big OEMs. It's public knowledge now. It's Microsoft, where we've consolidated the licenses. We're able to double the discount that we get from them as government. We're getting about 20% discount. We double that to about 40% discount. On the premise that we are now going to pull all the government demand for those licenses, that comes into enterprise productivity in the diagrams that I just put before. Pull the government demand there. And then we're saying to Microsoft that if a government department wants to buy a license, and I know that another government department has already bought and has excess licenses, we can enforce through norms and standards and other mechanisms, through infrastructure mechanisms, that government department cannot buy, but rather use what has already been bought by government. We're going further there by also saying that instead of every government department installing its software and individually, we're going to put all of that software in the cloud. And in fact, we also said that instead of government having to pay for that cloud and not being forced to use cloud that is sitting somewhere where we don't know for keeping government documents and so on and so forth, we are going to ask Microsoft to put that cloud infrastructure here. In fact, Microsoft announced last week that they are going to put one of their few, I think 7, global cloud infrastructure in the country right now. There will be one in Johannesburg and another one in Cape Town here. And that will serve the whole continent. And that came out of a drive from us and a push from us that we are going cloud and they better come here or we are going to build our own infrastructure. What that does is then say that moves us to the diagram on the right side where government departments now can consume of a common infrastructure and they don't have to buy individually. And we can also consolidate the buying of licenses. And then what that happens there is that CETA, instead of being an occasional service provider of licenses, becomes a mediator and an enforcer of consolidation. And then the same paradigm can then be applied to even government business applications. And when Treasury particularly talks about IFMS, we'll also note that the IFMS, the way it's been deployed, will now be deployed on cloud as well. The next page on page 9 is slightly more technical, but it shows that we're applying that paradigm not only on Microsoft on the productivity suite, we're applying that paradigm on IFMS and on every new application that we'll be building in the context of e-government jobs. And the page 10 then shows how we are doing this. Another view of essentially the same thing, that we have a common cloud infrastructure, reducing costs in a fundamental way, giving us a flexibility, on top of which we are now going to put our IFMS from the left side. When is that reference there to 0365, that's a Microsoft reference that was announced last week. And then the other things there that were called infrastructure as a service, for example, platform as a service. Platform as a service essentially saying that the thing that makes this computer work or the thing that make the mainframes work will now also be put on a common infrastructure, reducing costs fundamentally. And lastly, leading into the next presentation, is what we call the legacy systems. Those ones that were built in the 80s, Chairperson. Our idea is to modernize them, not only the applications themselves, which we'll talk about now, but how, where they sit, the hardware that on which they sit. We know, for example, that we pay, in certain cases, hundreds of millions of rand per annum on the hardware, and we know that we can reduce the cost significantly by even 50%. And we have examples of similar applications that were around the globe that are old. Based on COBOL, for people who may be aware of that, that are 30, 40 years old, where we never thought they could be migrated to this kind of environment that have been proven to, that have been indeed migrated. And then on page 11, we have a full infrastructure modernization project there with a dedicated team that is driving this. On page 12, we show that that in fact we introduced this cloud offer to government in, I think, in January as a test. By March, we had consumed our entire capacity, and now we are going to even double that capacity in the market. This is one of the most, in fact, the most successful program that CETA has put in the last 10 years. And I mean, I think quite important there, Chairperson, is to note that there are a number of public entities that don't have to use CETA and that have always found, or in fact, government departments, find ways of running away from CETA. And we now interact on the basis of legislation, of compliance, and so on and so forth.
But why?
And because we never had an offer. Absolutely.
And when you are talking to us, don't talk to us as if we are ignorant about what is happening.
No.
Because that is why we are bringing you here, because we have a serious concern about things.
Yes, Chairperson. And I just wanted to, in fact, one is not saying that there are no concerns. One is saying that there has not been many good offers. However, this example on page 12 says that an organization such as SANSA that we put there never had to use CETA at all. Does not have to use CETA. They came and they volunteered, they said, we want to use this offer that you have on the table, which is a disaster recovery offer. There's not been any interaction with them. Free State, for example, we have audit findings on disaster recovery. For the longest time, that the province there didn't have a disaster recovery system. The provincial DG, which I sat with him last year around this time last year, and we agreed on a program for disaster recovery, and we delivered that disaster recovery at the end of the year. We could not have done that had we been using the methodology, this old methodology, and we cannot deliver, and our ability to deliver is, in fact, if we don't change the way we do work, we will always be coming here with having to respond to complaints from departments. What we are saying, Chairperson, is that we are not there yet, of course, because we come from a long, legacy of non-compliance. We come from legacy where we have not been able to deliver on certain things. We have a few things where we have shown that new ways of working, new ways of managing, new ways of doing things, putting new products in front of people, can deliver. For the longest time, I think the members of the committee are aware that there's been a complaint from the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and even the Department of Higher Education and Training about the NCV system and our ability to produce certificates. We know that, for example, we had a backlog of about 238,000 certificates. As of today, we only have 5 of those. And that transformation happened only in the last 12 months, when the problem statement was raised in 2012. We couldn't have done that if we were not able to change things. And once again, I give examples of this kind of entities there that did not have to use the CETA. I'd like to go into our new approach to e-government, Chairperson, and maybe if I go to page 16 to say, is there any digitization of public sector? No. In fact, if we are asked what is the most successful implementation of e-government, the answer over the last 5 years, even more, has always been SARS with the e-SARS. In fact, if you are asked at CETA, what have we developed that has enabled government to digitize, that has enabled public services to be digitized, in fact, we have nothing to show for it. If we are asked, what examples do we have of where we have improved service delivery to the public using any metrics, whether it's in education or health, we don't have anything to offer. And that's because, Chairperson, we have always been an IT operations. We have not been operating on the basis of improving service delivery. But if we change our paradigm and saying our IT systems are there to improve, for example, the life cycle of a person, the prospects of a young person of getting employed once they exit the tertiary education system, then the IT system should be able to respond to the flow that is shown on page 16. The linkages between the Department of Home Affairs system, for example, and the early childhood development systems, which we don't have right now. The linkages between that and the system that is used by basic education, which or education in the provinces, which we don't have right now. The linkages between the basic education systems and the higher education systems, which we don't have now. And so on and so forth. But we are doing that now. Such that by the time we build the IT systems on page 18, we are not doing them in silos, but we are doing them in order to develop on the e-government system that the Mr. Mda was just talking about right now. On page 19, we also talk about the capacity of CETA to deliver the states. We confirm there that just on digitizing government interface to the public, we have been producing or replacing the paper forms at a rate of about 10 per annum, and there are about 1,900 forms that have to be digitized. And we're saying that at that rate, it will take us 190 years, and we won't be here. None of us would be here. However, there is a private sector out there. There is a capacity outside of CETA that can be used effectively in order to accelerate this thing. And so we are changing the way we are interacting with that capacity. In fact, not only saying that, we are saying that instead of just going and buying licenses and being subject to the way the private, I mean, so because right now what the private sector will do is buy this thing, and this thing will only change as and when I, as the owner of the intellectual property, changes. What you are saying now is that we are going to, the IP will stay with government, and we will use your development capacity, and you will be custom software developers, so that we accelerate the development of digitization there. We have not done that in the past, and that's a new model of working. So we
when did you take over the policy?
2015. So on page 20, we show some initial successes. We now have a portal, a personalized portal, where almost the information that you have given to government as an individual, we give it back to you, as and when it's based on how departments want to give it back to you. We have a portal that can track and give you a history of your participation in the public education system. We are developing a portal that links that history to the Department of Labor, or DTI, Small Business Development, and information that is contained in the Department of Labor, such that I can look at what I'm studying and I can see what the what opportunities there are in the economy for the skills that I'm building in myself right now. That information can also be used by other people. If I'm a mentor and I want to know how many people are studying, have studied or gone through this course or are in the middle of this course, I can go to a similar portal and get those statistics and mentor appropriately. That has been developed. We have developed a portal, for example, for Department of Small Business Development that is used to, for them to support small businesses. We are talking to the DPME about a portal that can be able to track government progress on the NDP, on the MTSF, on the MTS, and also on the APPs. And there are many, many other portals, Chairperson, that we are demonstrating. We have on page 23 a statement from a chief director in the DBE there, who confirms, and what we're confirming now, that in fact there has not been any innovation in the system. But they're confirming that what we delivered to them in a very short space of time last year was the first major technology innovation that is driven within the state system, developed by the employees of CETA directly. And the rest of it shows, I mean, we don't have to go into the details about what the functions of that, of how that application works. The next presentation, and I won't be long there, Chair, is on our application modernization, where we, on page 3, we state our problem statement. Our applications are outdated. It takes too long for them to respond to the needs of government, and they are quite costly to maintain. On page 4, again, we confirm what the committee members and everybody knows about the application environment. And then on page 5, we show what the business outcomes of our modernization program are. And then page 6, Chairperson, we show that there are many ways of dealing with this legacy. Some of these applications, for example, have to be retired. With respect to IFMS, the PESAs, the BES, the LOGIS, there's nothing you can do about them. They must be retired and replaced by modern technology, for example. In certain cases, however, they can be repurposed and then redeployed so that they can, because they still are able to work. And we saw from page 7 what each of the programs for rehosting or refactoring and even retiring entail. And then the rest of it is page 12 is probably the most important, to say that we have only started this program of application modernization in the 2016-2017 financial year, and it is a long program that is going to go on until 2020. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Remember, I suggest that we move on to National Treasury so that we can consolidate all these presentations together and probably get a different picture. I'm not sure if Mr. Mokachane is ready. Are you ready, sir?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I am ready. My name is Dondo Mokajane. I'm the Acting Director General in the National Treasury. I'm going to just make short, quick opening remarks, Chair, without being too detailed, whilst we're just getting ready to make sure that we actually present the right presentation that Lindy is going to lead. Lindy is the acting Accountant General. The Accountant General who is also acting is on leave, unfortunately. He's over.
All of you are acting here. We are at Hollywood today.
So, but she's Chief Director responsible for the IFMS project in the Treasury. But just to maybe as we are getting ready, you can now see where then IFMS will fit in the bigger scheme of things, in terms of the modernization program that government has engaged on to date. And clearly, I think the CEO did point towards the end that it then tells you that there are some legacy systems that obviously we need to change or we need to retire as and when we need to, because now it has become critical in this age of digital era that we are in, that then IFMS then becomes necessary and relevant in terms of looking at our whole IT infrastructure from a finance management point of view. Now, we have been faced with IFMS for some time, and what we are going to be doing, and Lindy is going to do that, is to then to date show you progress as to where we are in terms of all the sub-programs or subsystems or modules in the broader IFMS. In the module, we have supply chain, we have got finance, we have got HR, but a payroll, etc. So she'll really touch on a whole lot of those and take the committee through where we are. But she won't be alone. She is also with other colleagues from DPSA because, for instance, they will zoom in terms of the HR related module. And then we can then address, so for example, Madam Chair, the issue that you raised about defense and where it fits and so on. And they will kind of briefly talk to us about where we are insofar as, and I know we've been reading everywhere in the newspapers that there are some ghost workers. We are paying people that we don't know, etc. So to an extent, we'll also kind of highlight where we are just in terms of various modules, and then we can then later engage the committee on key matters that the committee may want to engage us on. Thank you very much. With your permission, shall ask Lindy to take us through.
Over to you, Lindy. Yes, Honorable
Sama, just hold on a second. Thank you. Before we proceed, before we go through the presentation, some of it doesn't make sense because there are a lot of abbreviations. So I'd just like to request that at the end, please explain some of the abbreviations, what they mean, or while you're going through the presentation, please clarify the abbreviations.
I hope, Lindy, you heard that. There's no debate, so you are going to try and save us from acronyms without telling us what they mean next. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, and thanks for the opportunity to discuss this program with you. I must say, being part of this program, you've also had to learn new terminology and new acronyms, so apologies if we assume everyone knows what we're talking about, but I certainly will address that as we go through. So we've already had, you know, the presentation previously that talks about the importance of what CETA is embarking on. And very importantly, the IFMS program is a strategic project for both the CETA, both and the Treasury and the DPSA. And for that reason, you will see our first slide, we thought it's important to show you, well, who's actually responsible, who are the role players, the decision makers around this program and the governance structures that we have put in place. So at a really strategic and leading level, we have a ministerial oversight and we have the steering committee. And these two bodies give direction to the program. Sorry, I see you might have the wrong version.
Do we have the same presentation?
There's different copies. Sorry, we brought additional copies.
No, I don't worry about the questions. I have a report on this report. And I'll be just going to your first slide. You just started your presentation on your first slide. So you just start looking
to us. Apologies, we reprinted it because this morning we thought it was probably better to start off with that, and so we brought additional copies. Can we just distribute those? Apologies.
Sorry.
Kenya, and we find advice the member jumping to the back of the presentation.
Honorable, can we use this particular presentation? Okay. This one.
Okay.
Please. Remember, we still have to engage on these presentations, members. Does everybody have this?
I have one now.
Okay, sure. Please proceed, really, so that we can move with speed. And I would have loved if you could finish your presentation, paper 11, because Honorable Soma has to go at 11:30, and I wouldn't like her to go without taking a bite on this, because she is actually being instrumental in us focusing on the issues around ICT. I mean, she's the one that is bringing the risk associated with it to our attention.
Thank you.
And unfortunately, as I said earlier on, members, unfortunately, Honorable Soma's house was broken into that night. She has to go back to them.
Okay. So just to go back to this, we thought probably gives you a good first look at the program by showing you what the governance structures are and to give you an idea of who the key role players are. It is a project between the three departments and entities. On the steering committee, we have the Director General of the National Treasury, we have the Director General of the Public Service and Administration Department, and the CEO of CSA. And these three parties make decisions around how the program will, what the direction the program will go to, and decisions around the implementation plans and the direction. What's important to point out here, over the recent months, we've worked quite closely with CETA and their modernization reforms to align our plan to the CETA's cloud technology in space. And we will be one of the programs that will play an important role in that, and we'll be deploying our solution within their new cloud environment, as mentioned earlier. We then have a program committee that sits under the steering committee that meets on every 2 weeks to discuss the progress and to monitor performance of the program. We have our own risk committee. We report to the audit committee. We have substructures also underneath there, such as a communications committee and a procurement committee, and these focus specifically on the activities of the program. So in the past, we would use existing structures within the department. We've now created our own so that there is focus specifically on the program according to methodologies that we have adopted. You'll see then we have what's circled there is the PMO, which is our program management office. So this is where we have specific skills that we've either insourced or we've brought in from CETA or we've capacitated ourselves that will assist us in delivering the program. So it's program managers, administrators, it's technical experts, communication experts, change management experts, and these people will come in and go off as and when they are required and as we progress down our implementation plan. I think the last thing I want to point out on the slide is that there is also an important engagement with the legacy environment so that we do take cognizance of what the legacy systems are, what the decommissioning will be, and the requirements for that and building those into our plan. So it's quite a collaborative structure, and it does cover all aspects that the program would need to touch on in order to deliver it successfully. I'm not going to go through the rationale too much because of the time constraints, but we also wanted to emphasize that this is an important program, obviously. Not because the legacy environments are old and outdated, but because of the way technology and governments and even companies are moving, and that they need a modern platform to assist them in doing their business. We need to know how many employees we have. We need to know how our money is being spent. And all of this type of resource management is important for us in order to determine what our government policies are and to help us drive decision-making in measuring the cost thereof. So we know that this is extremely important, and in order to hold government departments accountable for their decisions, we need to empower them with financial information that will assist them in making those decisions and giving you information to hold them accountable. So in terms of our value proposition for the IFMS, it is really changing our antiquated processes. Our processes are very manual. We have to fill in manual leave forms in a lot of cases. We get printouts of our payslips. We have a number of processes that have to be completed that can be shortened. So we really want to look at that and see how we can smooth processing and make spending in government a lot easier. We want to focus more on performance management and looking at outcomes and outputs rather than looking at, well, this is my budget, how am I going to spend it? But what am I spending it on? What regions is it being spent on? What are the type of projects that can be? And linking to the other systems that was mentioned by the CEO in the previous presentation. And most importantly is bringing government to the digital age. Why should government always be behind? Why should government not be leading technology developments and enhancements? We went previously on and investigated different systems, and we noted that the Austrian government, and you'll see there's a slide on them, they actually drove the development of a budgeting tool in the market because of their requirements. And why should government not be driving new developments in technology and not just be buying them at a later stage? So what are the possibilities? Transacting remotely. We all want to do things from our phones, and why can't we capture our leave forms, approve invoices? It makes it so much easier. Why do we always have to be at our desk and logged in onto a mainframe system? Contribute to more informed decision making, as I've mentioned. We want access to information, and not just how many cars I have. You know, we want a lot more intelligent information that can tie up our performance information to our spending, to our strategic plans. We want to be able to see that all in one picture. Render business processes more efficient. Let's try and cut through some of the clutter, make it a lot easier. Interface with Home Affairs so we know if we do have any fictitious employees, and we were able to identify any retired employees that are now eligible for pensions. And those type of interfaces and interactions between systems will give us a lot more information that we would require to keep our systems up to date. Automation, and what's importantly, and you'll see that through our central supplier database that we've already implemented, is allowing suppliers to engage with government. So suppliers can see, well, what's their tax affairs like? Suppliers can see, well, who's getting the work, etc. So allowing the outside world to engage with government and to see information that might not be available or that you would have to wait for when the annual reports are published. This is just, and I'm not going to go through it, but this is just some of the efficiencies we've seen in another government through the implementation of a enterprise resource planning system. And you'll see that they did realize efficiencies across the board in terms of people, processes, and costs. And we're hoping to be able to demonstrate the same to the public with our system. Just also to put into context where we are, we do have what we term IFMS 1 and IFMS 2. Now, essentially the difference between this is our delivery model. In IFMS 1, we saw that government wasn't catered for in the market. There weren't systems that supported government payroll, for example. In some cases, supply chain management processes were not supported by systems. And the decision was taken, we need to develop our own. So under IFMS 1, a lot of the delivery of the solution or the modern solution would have been relying on CETA and other technology houses to develop and to house a solution for us. When we re-looked at the strategy and we knew that there were problems in delivering, it came clear that while there are more solutions out there, technology is advanced, governments are implementing the likes of SAP, they're using Microsoft, they're using Oracle. Why don't we consider that? Why do we want to place a heavy reliance on our IT skills to maintain and build something when actually we can procure it and rather invest our infrastructure or invest our resources in our hosting environment and in other services that we can deliver to the public that relate specifically to our service delivery requirements. And this is what we took to Cabinet, and that's what IFMS 2 is about, is going to market, getting a complete solution which we can implement in departments without having, whereas IFMS 1 was, let's build a module, let's buy this, and rely heavily on an integration platform which does become a lot more costly in when it is fully developed and implemented. So what's important with any type of solution that is implemented is that it's not just putting a new application or putting a new system on your computer. We have to consider the people element, and that's where most of our costs are going to go to, is organizational change management. And we have identified a lot of strategies in that regard, but our focus is on the people and the change to our processes and the training that will have to be. CETA is taking responsibility for how it will be developed in their cloud. What we will be focusing on with DPSA is getting people to understand what the new solution will give them and giving them the skills to do that. We did, through our procurement process, in a year, or well, just 2 years ago, we went through a lengthy procurement process to buy the solution, and we then concluded a contract with Oracle. On the screen here, you will see this is what we have purchased. So our strategy was to buy one solution that covers, as the DG mentioned, finance, HR, payroll, business intelligence as well. So that's our information reporting. And these are all the applications that we procure. So if you look specifically under HR, there's quite a lot there with regards to functionality that we don't currently have in government. And also when it comes to project management, costing, and monitoring, there's also very, very antiquated systems in that regard as well. So this just gives you a snapshot of what we have bought. This also just gives you a snapshot. When we did the whole contract negotiation process with Oracle, we said, okay, just prove to us that your solution can cater to our needs. So we took our wish with regards to all those areas, and we compared it to the solution that they proposed. And that is the fit that was which was calculated. So you'll see the blue is pretty much says to us, the system can accommodate our requirements. This includes back pay, which I know which is a big issue for DPSA. It can do salary back payments. So we were quite comfortable that the solution did meet our current requirements. What this doesn't show you is the additional functionality which we don't have, so that we might not have thought of, and that's what we're going to go through in the next process to identify. I want to just touch on this slide, which is slide 22. Apologies for rushing forward. I think what's important here is to demonstrate that it's not just the project that you're going to hear about from time to time when we come to committees. We are going to start involving the business owners on this next phase of the program. What this means is we want CFOs, we want end users, we want accountants general, and line functions within departments to come together and to assist us in unpacking the solution, identifying where it is that we want to customize or configure, for example, and what it is the final solution will be. Our strategy that has been approved is going to be one size fits all. So all of the departments that act under the public service and administration will get one template which will be deployed on the cloud, and it will be applied by all, which makes it quite a lot more easier to maintain and to implement because it's the same solution. And so the business owners community, for the business community plays an important role in assisting us in making sure that what we deliver meets the needs and the requirements at the end of the day. We have had quite a useful discussion with Defence recently. They have said to us they are also bleeding. They want to look into modernizing their environment, and they've agreed that they would work with us in terms of their specific requirements and how that would be aligned to the IFMS and how they could perhaps implement the solution a lot earlier than we might have anticipated previously. So there's actually a good working relationship at this point in time with the Department of Defense. What we have said to them is, we're going to develop a generic template, and we would like you to look at your HR policies and practices and try and bring them also on board to align to our generic template. It makes it a lot easier if we're all operating under the same legislation, policies, and procedures. But that would be a process going forward. Just broadly, our timelines is discussed and set out in the slides. What we have committed to our steering committee is that we would now engage with business and to determine what would be the generic template, and it would cover all the functionality. We would then design this template and we would test it and pilot it at the Treasury and the DPSA as a first step. Once we're happy with this, we will then move into the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape, because we're broadly policy departments, so we want to see how this works in transport, agriculture, for example. We will test it there, and then it's available for broader implementation across the board. We know these timelines are far out in the future. We have put this together we've been quite prudent in putting this together, but we are constantly looking at, well, how can we shorten or how can we improve on our delivery? How can we give this opportunities to other departments to start testing this while we are in the lead site environment, for example? So those are the type of things that we are constantly looking at, what type of quick wins we can bring forward, but that would be something we would communicate as we have identified them and taken to our steering committee for approval. We have, and as I mentioned, we have DOD and we've had discussions with them. We know health and education have their own HR legislation and policies. We will be engaging with them to see, well, can we align? If we can't align legislation, how can we bring those in and potentially have a separate instance for the education sector or for SAP? But that will come after we have a generic template that should be standard for most public service and administration type of departments. I think in terms of the IFMS progress, that's the presentation.
Members, there you are. I'm hoping that Honorable Matao, there were issues you raised during your debate. And unfortunately, when we are debating, we are never able to engage on those issues. And I'm hoping that you are going to be able to, you are going to raise some of those issues, because I was taken aback myself. So, but I'm not putting you on the spot. I'm just saying, because this is the relevant platform, especially because it pertains to these issues. They all reference to even the ghost, I think it was the ghost employees or something like that. So members, there you are. The presentations have been made. I'm expecting your hands to be up. I have Honorable Dex, then I have Honorable Lisoma. Maybe on a point of privilege, Honorable Dex, maybe let's give Honorable Lisoma an opportunity to ask a question. Honorable Dex, is there any other hand, or all of you want to speak? Okay, we'll just go this way, okay? And if you could, I mean, we are taking all the different presentations, so I'm going to give all of them the opportunity to ask the questions, and we'll then open the floor for answers. Thank you. Yes, Honorable Lusoma.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Probably one, let me start by appreciating all the presentations and also to say at least this committee will ensure that departments, especially those that make government tick, they will move forward work as a collective for one objective. That's one, because I've just been listening to Trey, the structure, Ms. Linda was talking about the structure. The structure for me is important, but also the turnaround time. We are almost 24 years from 1994. We've incorporated different government as, or states, let me use that word, and the pace that we are moving, it gives a bad taste, let me say that. But having said that, I probably they have responded to this one because I walked out earlier on. I apologize,
no, they
but haven't. I will raise the issue that what informed defense not to be included initially in terms of IT, HR rationalization of your HR system as it were. What was the reason? Because it cannot be, because we have incorporated different armies in defense, and it's still an ongoing concern even today, the issue of verification and also issues of integration. Are we, because we are relying to those ones who make government tick, where is the low level of willingness to assist government to ensure that we close that chapter? And it cannot be correct. It doesn't make sense for anyone for more than 20 years or still battling with that. It cannot be political because some of the issues are more administrative than anything else. That's one. Two, Chair, it's not about only hearing the things on the media and all that. The question that I would like, which is be more to Treasury, I won't say Ms. Linda, I'll say Treasury, is that what policy or criteria you have used to prioritize? Of course, your good self, because you hold the money, which is not fair from where I'm sitting, but also prioritize Western Cape, because there must be a tool that we have used. Because the most worrisome provinces, which have been on the news almost every day, that embarrasses this government, they are not prioritized. And I do have an issue on that, Chair, because that's why we precisely requested the presentation. But one would like to know, is there any policy that guides us, or is it because we are situated in Cape Town? Because the most money, whether it's a perception or not, it seems to be leaking to other spaces, not the spaces that you are targeting. The issue, I hope you have probably silently, or I didn't hear that one, the issue of archiving, having the issue of risk management, if anything happens. I.e., for example, is it not Treasury not worried if the housing department, their offices get burnt down for whatever it is, electricity fault or whatever, and all documentation disappears? Because also in terms of scanning those documents, I don't think we have started as national government. I hope I'm right on that one, Chair. For me, then, in short, Chair, one would love, as this committee, that when we do our oversight role, at least we do have a turnaround target, that we know that before current administration lifespan, which is 2019, we would say that we have got a vendor or ICT CETA that is going to make sure that at this time at least we'll be rolling out the issues of HR in particular, because that's where also we are issues of ghost workers who can't verify public servants manually when you call them and say, because it will take you more than 20 years to do that. And that's a wasteful expenditure that is there. There are other issues, but we want to deal with that one. But also the issues of abuse of HR policies, your ill, your pillar policies that is being abused, you can't monitor that one, your performance and so forth. The point is, Chair, let me just close by saying that what can we do as this committee to assist the key role players, which is Treasury, ICT, CETA, and also DPSA? What policy do we need then to talk to? Because you said also the issue of also alignment of ICT policy, not one jacket fits all, but saying those ones which are across the departments, that also can assist the government to streamline and to walk the talk in terms of e-government, as it were, Chair. When can we have that? What is the problem? What do we need to do? But also, with all what we're supposed to have done, how much have we spent, and how are we going to save those monies that we spent on ICT that doesn't give us value for money, which AG has been raising and MPET Research has been raising time to time, Chair? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Honorable Tess.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start with the Treasury, which was sketched, that first sketch you came up with, and for us to better understand this thing here. Well, I'm trying to understand this thing. I'm trying to make sense of this thing here. You raised the issue that you bring expertise in from CETAs and stuff like that. Now, if you bring, I just want to find out what my point that I'm trying to what I'm trying to understand here is the cost implications here. Firstly, these expertise that you bring from outside, from CETAs, is there any cost attached to it, and what is the cost? I need to know and to understand figures, what is the cost. Then, secondly, is there also other private consultants that you are bringing in, from the private sector consultants that you are bringing in to assist you with this implementation here, and what is the cost that's attached to that? Then, coming to the real issue here is that, if my understanding is correct, this is about 19 years or more that you are busy with the system from its inception. And I would have loved to have a discussion with the doctor on this matter, on this issue here. To hear hearing in previous engagements with you, you seem very knowledgeable about IT. And I would like to hear your private, your personal views on the system. And maybe you will not comfortable to say it here, but I would like to have maybe a one-on-one engagement to hear from you, is this really worth it? Because it's 19 years now. What is the cost? What is, I want figures, because you should be able to tell me the cost for 9 years. How much did it cost? How much did it cost government for the last 19 years that we are fiddling with this thing here? And how, and why is it taking so long to implement it? Why is it taking so long to implement it? Yeah, let me see, is there any other question? No, that's the two. It's the why it's taking so long to implement. What is the cost implications thus far? Do you bring in private consultants to assist you? What is the cost attached to that? CETA expertise you bring in, what is the cost? Because we need to understand the cost implications here in the system here. How much has the cost now? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And I also take the opportunity to say thank you very much for the presentation. That I'm happy, you broadly spoke about service delivery through CETA, that is the modernization approach. I would like you to localize it to a problem that we experience in as far as frontline services are concerned. Maybe if you could go into some specific interventions that would begin to clear the cobwebs in my eyes. And you don't spoke again about, my other concern is the federal approach, what seems to be a federal approach to me between the provinces and the and national, so to speak. What measures are you taking to integrate or to consolidate your approach, given the rationale that you put behind the silo mentality that prevails? It will also assist, you maybe will also try to explain the paradigm that we have adopted in order to deal with this problem.
Chairperson, I think it's Linda. Linda, ne? Oh, Linda, no? Okay. The outsourcing, I'm talking about Oracle. The outsourcing of government information, it will always be a cause for concern. Do you think, will that not pose a problem? Because we are outsourcing very critical government information. What do you put in place as a proactive measure to deal with the security in as far as government information is concerned when we are outsourcing to an outside person? Where does Oracle come from? Who is Oracle? You indicated that it should have been procured some 2 or 3 years ago. But as my colleagues have indicated, we're talking about 2005. If it is 2 years ago, it's up to 2015 or 2014, if not 13. What has been happening? And how much expenditure has gone into the exercise? Was the exercise canned? And if it was canned, what is the reason behind that? And why was it canned? Given a lot of money that has gone into that. Chairperson, there is also an issue of licensing. My little understanding is that for each license you've got to pay. Now, how much does each department has to pay for a license? Over a period of 20 years or 23 or 15 years, whatever, each department has got to pay. Now, you multiply that per annum, and then multiply it by the number of years it has taken. Now, Chair, to me it says, I don't know whether that's the first piece that you spoke about. I might have missed that. So to me, that first phase was actually a disaster. Mm-hmm. And the approach in terms of your explanation, it's like we are in 2004, 2005. It is then that you come out with this plan. But already, to me, as far as I'm concerned, or my little understanding is concerned, it has been canned because it has collapsed, or it did not work, to put it in simple terms. What are the plans, Chair, for support by the province? Obviously, it's going to go to the provinces for implementation. What support is there? Is there any plan in as far as the support by the provinces is concerned for this thing to succeed? Can I go back again to Oracle? I pose the question, who is Oracle? Or what is Oracle? And I've got little information that Oracle is an American company. It's an Australian company. Have we exhausted local capacity? Or local capacity does not exist at all? Does Oracle implement everything that has to be implemented, or you have subsidiary companies, and which are those? I'm sorry, now, Chair, I'm now treading into SCOPA territory, which might be misconstrued for something else, but we are talking about the capacity of government to implement policies regarding the HR, and that is their mandate. That is why I end up having to cross the line. So, what is the involvement of local black small business, whatever you call it, in as far as this Oracle thing is concerned? Chair, I think I've exhausted. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Honourable Kondebat.
Chair, thanks. I won't repeat some of the questions I had, but I just want to point out one or two things. And the one thing is this. I think one of the biggest challenges is that, and we've seen it in basic education when it comes to ICT, your staff component is the biggest because they're the most scared of this whole thing. How are we going to get over that? If I'm correct, you have like 1.3 million public servants in government. That's one of the things. And especially at the lower level, and I've had the experience of these type of systems in the health department in Limpopo, for example, where we are still waiting and millions down the drain, no info, etc. And I think there are a lot of examples like that. But what I'm quite interested in is the time frames of this up until where it started till today, as was asked. And doctors said that this is a, there are billions at stake and you might come to a saving of about 50%. So my question is, to come to that stage, what is the expenditure? How much are we giving out to buy then when the saving actually starts? Because I think that says a lot as well. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, yes, I am
looked
and
honorable thing, yes, thank you, Chair. Oh, let's see. Okay. Now, given the stories we've seen in the newspaper about possible Russian interference in the American election last year, I would like to know how secure our system is and what have you got in place to ensure the security and safety of our entire government system. Then, Mr. Madal. If you look at the e-government governance challenges, reference has been made to ICT managers and staff and et cetera, not fulfilling their responsibilities. They're not compliant with the controls established to secure and regulate their departments. And there's the one thing that is absolutely worrying is the fact that there is a lack of consequence management. I would like to know what have you got in place to deal with this problem, and how vulnerable does it leave us when people are not doing what they are supposed to be doing. For example, I would like to know if you know, there was reference made to fraud and financial mismanagement and fruitless and wasteful expenditure and so on. I would like to know if you know what the extent of the fraud and the mismanagement, et cetera, is. Then, I think I heard you say that departments can decide on their own what system they are going to use. Is that correct? Can departments decide what system they... So it's a one uniform system. Okay. Then that question falls away. And then just last thing I would like to know, you say that you are merging systems. I would like to know what the implication for job losses are. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, Honorable Muta.
Thank you very much. Let me start with my cousin. He probably doesn't know this, Mr. Mudau. Nandu Mudau, you know, they tell me my grandfather was married into the Wakwenas, and that's why we became Mudau instead of Mudau. that's actually a true story. My big issue, you state the problem really well.
Absolutely. We do this over and over and over again. And then you end with a punchline, lack of consequence management. What are we going to do about this? People don't do what they're supposed to do. We pay them lots and lots of money. We know where the problem is. We don't do much about it. So we are like on a treadmill over and over again. Next year, if we have this session, we'll probably go through the same things again. My question is, what are we doing about consequence management? There's a report we just came up about the Public Service Commission about some of the things they're doing. Are you working with them to make sure that these guys get punished? Are you working with DPME to make sure that these issues get raised? Now, if you look at your slides, you will see that on your implementation progress of ACTS are continued, that unfortunately they are not numbered. You'll see the regression if you will go from 2014 to 15 and 2015 to 16. Clearly a regression. Something is wrong there. People are not doing what they're supposed to do. That consequence management thing is important. Leads to the question, as far as ITC is concerned, do we have or do the departments have the requisite skills to do that? Which links directly with the presentation by CETA. Human resource and skills base. Do we have in this country sufficient young people in those areas with the requisite capacity who are going to carry these nice, good plans that we have? Do we have these young people? And I'd like to acknowledge, you know, Dr. Mahapi, I believe it is, yes, being candid with us about these things. It confirms my own picture and image of what CETA has been about. So I'm asking the question again. Do we have the techies? They call them techies, you know that, right? The technicians. Do we have enough of these young people to do the things that we want to do? And finally, most important in this regard, your timelines for implementation, 2016, 17, 18, good. And you said you're being, you know, conservative about it because you don't want to do that. My experience is that in business, and you guys are in business, nothing important happens unless you have champions. Do you have champions? Do you have champions? In our case, in your case, in this particular instance, will be the ministers, the CEOs. Do you have champions, people with gravitas who will say, this is going to happen, and it will happen? Thank you.
Yes, Honorable Member.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentations. I want to point out the cloud issue. You mentioned the cloud matter. So I'd like to know, who does the cloud belong to? Does it belong to us? So do we upload and manage the cloud ourselves? So there's nobody else who has access to it? Or does it belong to America or like Microsoft? So all our government information will be uploaded to the cloud. Who will protect the cloud and who will manage it? Also, you said the cloud controls information from the continent. You didn't say just South Africa, you said the continent. So who then really controls that cloud? And I'd like to second what Honorable Modao has asked as well. And previously we had a presentation regarding the pension payouts. So many of our people pension payouts have been delayed because they don't have the documents are missing, etc., all these excuses. So will there be a central place to make it easier for our people that when they resign or when they retire, their pension payouts are expedited? Because are you not working with the people running the government pensions? Also heard a presentation from Public Service Center of Innovation. On our oversight, we did visit their center, and we were very impressed with their work. So my question is, I didn't hear anything from you about the center. Do you have a relationship with them? And if you are not working with them, why is the reason? Because they are a center of innovation. And there are a number of expert people, innovative people, who do work at that center. And you mentioned disaster recovery. You mean only for the computers, the software? So you're not talking about, you know, national. You mean only like the computer. So I just want to be clear. disaster recovery for who, for what? For a specific computer or for apps, or what exactly does the disaster recovery include? Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Dex, you wanted to say that thing quickly, but I will give you an opportunity, members, another round. Let's finish this round and then we can get the answers from National Treasury, CETA, and DPSA.
I won't take it the second round. This is the final thing I want to say on this thing here. You see, I must stress that as the committee responsible for monitoring in government, I must stress it to Treasury that we are very, very concerned about IFMS system. We are very, 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 very concerned. I'll tell you why. See, the Honorable Member Ntombela raised the issue about Oracle. You need to tell us also what was the tender processes there. Because you see, Treasury must understand, you must not undermine us. You must be able to feel and understand the policy direction and the direction government is taking into. You come with this American system when you could have went to to India. You must understand the direction this government is flowing into. Why have you explored the BRICS countries? Have you gone to BRICS countries? You'll run to the Americans. They were never our friends during the anti-apartheid struggle. But then whenever government wants, whenever you'll do things in government, first thing that comes in your mind is the Americans. You'll run there like you'll have friends there that you'll want to trade with. You must go and explore the BRICS countries, because that's the direction that this government is moving into. It's fine if there's another government in future, you can go into that direction. But currently, move in the direction that we are going into. Don't go to the Americans and go look for a thing with sensitive government information. The Honourable Member raised the issue about what security measures has been put in place. But I really want to know, was there a tender process in place? And that you explore the international markets properly, especially the BRICS countries. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before I give you the opportunity to respond, I wanted to say to you, you know, I've listened to the three presentations, and as somebody who has just finished reading a book, Exponential Organizations, by I think it's Salim Ismail. I'm not sure if you've read that book. You guys, I honestly don't get the sense that you actually understand that the gravity of the challenge that we are sitting with when it comes to the ICT platforms that we are using as government. And I also don't get the sense that we are learning from the challenges that we've had previously. We are sitting with departments that I won't mention their names, who have procured operating systems that have never been used, but they've spent billions. And I'm not getting that sense, Sita, that you are actually grappling with those issues. I'm not. I would be lying to you if I'm saying you are. All I'm just hearing my normal, technocrats coming to before the portfolio committee to make a presentation just to massage the committee so that the committee can feel that something is happening when something is not happening. Now, this very committee in 2010, And I thank my research team for bringing this to my attention. This committee heard from DPSA that it was migrating to the IFMS system. And the reason for that was because PESEL was just giving them so many problems. And I'm not getting the sense that we are dealing with the issue of PESEL now. And our members, when all the time we get the issue of ghost employees, is not somebody's fictitious thing. The issue of the duplication of data, the issue of the vulnerabilities, these are not just issues that that we are just creating, that are just a figment of our own imagination. These issues are happening. They are real. They are there. And I'm therefore uncertain about where exactly are we going. And I think the point is that one we need to get from you to give us a sense, one I need to know, has DPSA, National Treasury, CETA and DPME ever met and had a meeting where they are actually even assessing the impact of the digital revolution on the state? Have you ever done that? We are now, everything is on algorithms now. And we should be, by now, I should be hearing something that is telling me that, you know, we are not going to be spending so much money, for example, on textbooks, because we should be getting more textbooks on the tablets for students and dictionaries and whatever. In other words, we need to be reducing the money that we're spending on those things. But I'm not getting that adrenaline rush into that. I'm just getting the same old story. And what is worrying me is that, unfortunately, and I said to you, I've read this thing about exponential organizations. If the thing is, we are still talking about intellectual property rights and whatnot. The reality is that departments are procuring these things, they sign agreements, but as they do that, a new, much faster, more efficient technology is invented, and they are sitting with intellectual rights thing, and they still have to service this. What are we doing about that? What are we doing about it? And again, I'm also having very serious concerns, and I think Honorable Dex and Honorable Dombela have raised this thing. The security of the information. You know, there are two main things, platforms that are going to be, that may cause the third world war, whatever. One is with the issue around water, but the other one is ICT. And I don't get, now we are told that you are, CETA is telling us that now, no, you've decided that, okay, the story you gave us about Microsoft and having to bank the whole information on iCloud and so forth. What happens if, who controls that information where we are storing our data, where we are putting it? Who controls that? What happens if that crashes tomorrow and it's controlled elsewhere? We have no say necessarily on how it's, you understand what I'm saying? How do we ensure that how do we ensure the security of that? And the cyber warfare is something that has started more, as we see it in the small scale, you know, people fighting over these social media or whatever. But there is a bigger thing than that. And I'm not sure if we are actually dealing with those. And it concerns me because I know that in the U.S., how serious they are taking this issue is that the government has also even, they brought in their top teams to begin to look at the risks that are associated with this. But I'm looking at us saying more, talking more about outsourcing. No, it's outsourcing to Microsoft. No, if we've started doing this thing. And I'm worried. I'm honestly worried. I'm not sure if we understand this thing. Another thing that is of serious concern to me is that our systems are not integrated to a point where I can, as a politician, be able to say, you know, this is the person, this is the child that was getting the social grant, and this child received, because their mother or whatever, or father, they also received the low-cost housing. They also received a free basic water. They also received free electricity. And I needed to be monitoring this child until this child gets to NFSAS and exits the system as a dependent on the state. I'm not getting that sense. I'm not sure if we are talking the same thing if we are talking about these integrated systems. It looks like we are talking about completely different things. To me, when we are talking about that, I'm talking about us the capability of the state. And remember this thing, I'm not inventing, it's in the NDP. If we are talking about a capable and developmental state, what are we talking about? I mean, if we are talking, right now, we can't even get accurate data as to exactly how much is it costing the state to support an individual indigent family, simply because we have not integrated these systems. Home Affairs is there, yes, and we are talking about biometrics, informing biometrics data. But that biometrics data that is sitting there, I'm not sure if we are able to even factor that same metric, that the biometrics data, into our own system that we are using to pay employees, so that when the employee dies, you know that that person has exited the system. And you are not going to be sitting with the problem that I watched just a day ago, a few days ago in ETV. There's this guy who is now battling to be restored as a person who is still alive. I'm not sure if you saw that story. And we are not speaking to those issues. We are saying, Lindy, you are saying, we are not just talking systems, we're talking people. But it doesn't feel like it. Because if our system are such that in the age of biometrics, in the age of algorithms, there could be somebody, because that person is duplicated fourfold. How does that happen? Because there can only be one, I mean, there can only be one biometrics that I have. And if this person is saying, is justifying that, no, I'm still alive, but they are saying, no, they've subsequently discovered there's somebody else who has the same name, same ID somewhere in KwaZulu-Natal, and this person is sitting somewhere in Gauteng. Now, to me, something is fundamentally flawed with the way we are moving with these issues. We have a lot of issues that are here, and we know that the IMF, the IFMS, you know, intends to decommission the PESA, PAS, Logis, and Vulindlela system. But how far are we? I mean, we keep on talking these things all the time about these issues. I'm not getting the sense that we actually wanted to get out of those systems. And again, with CETA. CETA, the reason most departments are very, very frustrated with you, and I can tell you because at some stage I was chairing the committee on the future payment system of social grants and in 2014. And we tried to engage with you because one of the things that we were worried about, that SASA, by the way, which is something that we've never spoken about, had invested more than $2 billion on another operating system. And it didn't seem as though people even knew how to use it. And how much of these wastages are sitting there? How much are they? Are they as a result of the weaknesses that we are experiencing at CETA? What are we doing to turn CETA around so that CETA is central in this thing? And the reason why we are going to be hard on CETA, it's because CETA is our information. We are expecting that you should be driving the technological advancement for us. And the National Treasury also has should take a keen interest in this. Because even the face of capital, the National Treasury, is changing. And if we are not adapting, unfortunately, we'll find ourselves as this country, be finding ourselves in the back foot. And I'm worried that I don't also think that National Treasury is prioritizing these issues. If we are sitting with the Department of Defense, that is telling us that for some strange reason, it was not a part of the integration when we were beginning to integrate the systems. And we are 23, 24 years down the line. It's 2017 now. And we are still talking about the defense that is telling us that they have an imminent, because how they reported to us is that the imminent collapse of their systems collapse is imminent. And that is going to have serious implications. And you need to be able to answer this thing. So basically, we need to understand what is happening with this migration, because I'm not getting the sense. Maybe, remember, the reason why we are saying this If our migration is so slow, we are going to be overtaken. And I agree with you, especially with this thing of property rights and intellectual rights, because you will remember what happened to all the Motorola, the Kodak, and what have you. You end up, you can have this thing, and then somebody comes with something that's much better when you are still waiting with this, you are still sitting with this intellectual right that is no longer, that has become obsolete, but you are servicing it. And that has implications for National Treasury. So we really want you guys to respond on this, and we also want you to tell us exactly whether CETA is now geared. Is it a vehicle that we can depend on as the government? And we also want you to know whether DPSA has actually become central to this. Remember, we are integrating this, because we had the workshop on PIR the other day, and we discovered how the system is being abused. The people are claiming other people, even the whole thing of the leave and so forth. It's just a messy situation that we got, and we wanted to see all these things being put together so that CETA, DPSA, DPME, a National Treasury, they are looking at this thing, not in silos, because the other departments, they if they don't get the cue from us, where else are they going to get the cue from? We are saying DPME because it's responsible for planning. And the planning, if we are talking planning can't be divorced from the age of algorithms, because that's where we are right now. And it can't be divorced to the next fourth revolution, industrial revolution, which is going to be more around robotics, and it's going to have huge implications even on our own revenue. And that is why we are talking about you in this instance being at the center of driving this thing, so that government is able to meet the demands of this in the future. And finally, I wanted to know whether are we futuristic in the way we are looking at this issue. We are told that Africa by 2050 is going to be having 2 billion people. And if we are not, if our IT systems are not sorted out, we are going to end up with serious problems. Already your cities or your municipalities that are on the border, they are having serious problems. We went on oversight visit. People, because South Africa, and we can't run away from that, the reality is that we are the most advanced economy in Africa. And people are coming across, they are coming to our areas, and they deliver babies there. And then before you know it, they are also getting into the system. We need to be able to be thinking about those things, because remember that your taxpayers, we don't want to be at odds with our taxpayers. When they are paying tax, and remember, our tax is coming largely from us now, as individual tax contributors. It's your PIT, that's your major tax bracket. So the reality is that it's no longer the corporates that you have to be worried about. You have to worry about us, because we are the ones that are funding the past. The individual people, yourself, you are paying, your payers, you earn, and so forth. Are we really giving the people the right value for money? I went into your website, this is what you are claiming, but I'm not getting it when you are presenting. But here, we want you to respond. We will give you some of the questions that our research teams have put together, because we want written responses. But we want you to seriously consider that. Honorable Fondabat wants to say something very briefly before you come.
Yeah, sorry, that was my third point, and then you mentioned this now. Is even in Treasury... Treasury last week, according to reports, also found that, for example, when you speak about the integration of the system across board, found, for example, 12,000 people who passed away already,
yes,
still doing business. Now, you know, I can't see that even the systems we have currently can't pick it up. So what guarantees are there in the new system? And then there was a decision taken to blacklist public servants doing business with government. Yet, the report is out, 14,000 people still do, of which we know. So
by the way, before that, just to interject, Honorable Madau had said that thing during his debate, budget debate, and I was hoping that, and that is why earlier on I was trying to remind him of that, because that speaks to the point that you actually labored on that day, that says you have 12,000 people, is it 12,000, yeah, people who are deceased, but they are still doing business with the state. How can that be? And that speaks to our IT platforms. Are they current? Are they up to date? Are they able to detect these issues? And in the age of biometrics, how is that possible? Anyway, proceed to...
Well, Chair, that's the point. Is it people that was in the system and they died, passed on? Or is it people that actually identities being used as fake companies? I mean, the system should actually be telling you that as well. If you pass on and you register... at the office of Home Affairs that somebody's passed on, it must cancel across the country. But I mean, it's not two people, it's 12,000 people, which is quite a significant number, Magnus. If you just think of what we know, there might be more. And especially in the more rural provinces, where guaranteed, I'm sure all of you know, CETA must know, it's up for shambles in those provinces. You're not going to get this going there. The trend that's going now, you actually lose out before it starts.
Anyway, can I give you the opportunity to respond? I'm not sure if we will start with DPSA if they want to react. DPSA, which is the reason why we want you to react to what the members are saying, is primarily because you are the department that is at the coalface, and when it comes to all the things that are happening in the public service and administration, it's your first point of call, and you are the committee that is overseeing.
Thanks very much, honorable members. I think one needs to start off by acknowledging the fact that there is a need for the three departments, including the three institutions, including DPME, to work together as the center of government to deal with the challenges that is facing the public service. And secondly, to highlight the fact that within the team that is dealing with the IFMS project, we have got a component that is coming from DPSA, that is looking at the HR matters, because the HR belongs to the DPSA. Now, to respond to the direct questions from honorable members regarding DPSA presentation, firstly, I think the presentation on e-governance is an effort to make sure that there are systems in place to make sure that there is proper control. Now, when I mentioned the issue of fraud, if I may give an example, it's for the fact that if we allow IT acquisitions within institutions to be taking place or to be concluded by individuals, it gives a right for them to go for their preferred bidders who might be in a corrupt relationship, whereas the corporate governance needs that decisions to be taken by a committee, which is the ICT steering committee within a department. So the corporate governance is trying to come up with institutions and the structures that will be able to take control of the ICT decisions that are taken within a department, which means those decisions needs to be under the prescripts of the public service regulations, in such a way that then, if it is happening through an ICT steering committee, unlike if it is happening through an individual, we are able then to curb issues of fraud. That is why we are referring to the issue of fraud. On the issue of the consequence management, I think it is a question of increasing awareness within departments, because usually when there is a problem that involves a loss of money, people will be taken, they know they will be taken up to SCOPA, for instance. But if it is an issue that concerns non-compliance to corporate governance, for instance, people were not being taken very seriously. So I think it's a question of creating awareness within the institutions that we need to take consequences even for people who disregard the public service regulations or who disregard the issues that deal with the corporate governance of ICT. So I think through the creating awareness, we might be able to deal with the issue of consequence management for IT managers who flout the rules on corporate governance. Thank you, members.
The PSA, maybe this will require a written response. We wanted to know the vacancy rate of the CIOs, because we've noticed that quite a number of departments, they are battling to fill up those positions. And we don't know whether is it because we are not producing enough. I mean, even in your own department, we haven't filled that position. It's vacant, hence we are acting, isn't it? And it's not only with you. We are picking up in different departments, but we need to understand what, you know, to get the picture of what is happening, maybe throughout the state, you know, because it's a concern. Maybe we are not producing enough of those people, and maybe we are not also having a relationship with the institutions that are meant to be producing these critical skills. How else are we going to go as to move forward as a country if we are not filling those critical positions? Because the reality of the situation now is that more than ever before, ICT is actually central to how we deliver services as government, you know, which means that we really, really have to focus on that. I'm also asking that because when I was in my old capacity with SASA, one of the problems we had a big problem with trying to get a CIO, to fill the CIO position at SASA. And I think it might be a problem that we may only be thinking that it's affecting you, whereas maybe it affects the entire public service and administration, you know. So if you could ensure that we get a written report on that, that give us the sense of what exactly is happening on that score. National Treasury.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think we really appreciate the robustness of the engagements in this committee. I wish all committees that we sometimes go to should all be like this, because what that helps us is to really get going and inspire some confidence in us to really make sure that delivery happens in our own little corners, in whatever responsibilities that were given to us, and the imperatives outlined by the National Development Plan to ensure that we deliver. So that we really appreciate the engagement. Without being defensive, Chair, I thought maybe, and then this is, when you look at our own programs and our own evolution as a department, from 94, if you want to call it that, or, you know, at least we've since been there from, say, 97, 98, 99. A long-term view of issues became quite critical as we evolved. And also realizing that come 94, and I cannot preach to the converted yet, come 94, we had many challenges. From a systems point of view, merging 14 education departments, merging 14 health departments, and I've seen it from 98, that evolving, how difficult it was, firstly to know which schools you have and how many there are in the provinces. And I can comfortably say it took us a few number of years to find our feet as a country from a finance point of view. We did not... It took us at least 10 years by 98, 99 to really know what we were doing from a budget reform agenda point of view. When we were reforming our budget, merging all those budgets and understanding the challenge that we were having, it took us at least 10 years. And then at the same time, we had something called the Exchequer Audit Act of 1956, which didn't help the situation. 1998-99, when you're grappling with writing the PFMA and finally passing it in 99, that's when we kind of had an idea what we are doing. And then when we did the Municipal Finance Management Act and we started implementing it around 2003, and if you remember, Chair, we did not implement all sections. We had to stagger them. Why did we stagger them? And that's something, it's important to have a historical perspective. We were learning as we were going along. We were trying to untangle the apartheid legacy and what apartheid brought to us, by the way, which we shouldn't forget as we approach. And that's why, for instance, wanting to understand then the implementation, we had to look at, as we roll it out slowly, you had a Western Cape which was developed in terms of its systems from the Cape administration point of view. And again, think about House of Assembly, House of Delegates, House of everything. And then we had to then go to the extreme of the Eastern Cape in terms of the challenges, homeland, rural, skills levels low. So we wanted to see and understand, and not because of any other reasons, why we chose the Western Cape. Because yes, we have challenges in other provinces, but this is as a pilot in a rolling out point of view. So I'm saying that the historical perspective is important, and we have to deal with a lot. In the Treasury, as an example, there were people that, and I can imagine, if you have to duplicate that across or replicate that across all departments, you'll pick it up that there were people who just had to leave, who on their own left because they didn't like transformation, they didn't like the shape of our foreheads, if you want to call it that. The former DG used to say that. But the reality is that you dealt with a lot of challenges. People were not prepared to change. New people were to learn new skills. And those of us who came in some cases were people direct from university, direct from training and so on, who had to understand. Now, if you have to translate that into why we did not, in the first 10 years, move at great speed in terms of IFMS or any of the system, it's important to take that into account, that in institution building, and we've learned that and we've been talking about it, Jay, in a number of years, in building institutions and especially public institutions with the kind of history that we have, I'm not giving an excuse, and I said at the beginning, 23 years then tells you that it's like 1 or 3 months or 2 days in the history of developing governance, whilst noting that we don't have time. People need delivery, inequality is increasing by the day, poverty is a challenge. We've got, as the previous president used to say, we've got two economies in South Africa, the first and the second economy. That's the reality. And I don't think it's an excuse that government came up with to say we need to focus, we need to change. And you can call it whatever we've been calling it from 94 in terms of our reform and RDP agenda, to the new growth path, to what we have currently in terms of time, all in the sense of trying to develop our economy, including developing institutions that we have. Secondly, I think there are many questions, Chair, that I think we need to give a proper answer, because once if we are going to be flouting, we might not be doing justice to you as a committee, and we would want to come back to you in giving you proper written responses, if it means that on Dombele, in terms of the cost. I can say we are spending so much now, but I want to be able to give you the cost on this project, in particular IFMS, from when it started today, both IFMS 1 and IFMS 2, in terms of the cost and what we're currently spending per Honorable Drakes, in terms of the people that we have, as whether it's Oracle, whether it's any of the people who are in the program management office, so that the committee can then interact and can know that. So on the finance stuff, in terms of our spending, we should be able to make that available without any. It's simply going into the systems, going to our archives in some stage, because if you look at 2005 spending, obviously some information has been archived. And we are not saying it's not available. It is available. We will certainly make it sure. And finally, Chair,
I understand that you need to still, you want to give us a proper costing of how much it costs, but I can safely tell us, we won't hold you to it, that it must be running in the billions.
No, and can I protect him there? I think it's fair because these questions are coming up now, and information that is going to involve figures, it's always best if you get it from written sources. Because if they're going to be giving us that, it might actually become a query. Next time you come here, you are giving us something else, and we say, no, you misled the committee. I think it's only fair to treat it that way, Honorable Tech, please. I don't think, I think let's leave it at that, but proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair. So finally, Lindy will touch on more technical aspects as raised, and then respond directly to some of the questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, they will give us the question. We agree with you there. We agree with you. They must give us that. But you must remember that this question is also linked to the question that I asked about how much are we losing on these different IT platforms that are happening in all the different departments under the proposed, they paid billions and they are not even using those systems. Others are sitting with, you know, the intellectual property, right, because they have to pay for that, they have a contract. But what they have is already outdated, but maybe they have signed a contract for 10 years for using that operating system or whatever, you understand? So we need to be, we need to apply our minds well when it comes to that, because it got to be, we need accurate information so that going forward as the committee we're able to monitor and oversee whether you are making progress or not in this, because our main concern, you must remember, this whole thing is coming within developing a capable and developmental state. And that's in the NDP. And we feel that ICT is central to that. Yes, please.
Thank you. I'd like...
Eighteen months to implement. We're talking phase two and phase one and phase two, which has taken about 15 years or so. And there was a time when a decision was taken to say, from this point up to this point, we seem to have not succeeded in carrying out our task. So there should have been financial implications there too. There should have been decisions or discussions about the financial implications thereof. And the implementation of the second phase, the same. So I think Comrade Dex is merely saying what is the possibility? Look, we're talking licenses for implementation of these solutions, isn't it? Licenses for each province. We've got nine provinces. Let's suppose, for argument's sake, we say each license costs us five million per month. You'd be able to multiply that by 12. It gives you 60 million. Multiply that by the number of years. I'm just saying.
I'm hearing you and I wanted to say to you, maybe let the DG maybe give us that indication now,
because
it looks like you want it now.
Just an indication. Like, I will welcome the written information
DG,
as well.
Acting DG,
we will
DG, I'm unable to protect you. I have to keep my members waiting because, I'm merely a chair, but the people that are here, they have a mandate. So they need to know from you. I don't think they want to get you out of the hook. They want you to pronounce something. Otherwise, they won't be able to sleep tonight. And I want my members to be healthy so that by tomorrow when we meet again, they are fresh. I don't want them to leave here with a frustrated expectation.
So DG, help me out.
No, I will help you. I will help you, and I will also try and help the committee. And and I think we acknowledge, Honorable Dombela, that there are two phases. And we said this project started in 2005, and at some point we went to cabinet, and I think our slides, yes. And certain, now, I need to go back to that CAP memo, because we must have told cabinet. I can tell you now, there's no CAP memo that doesn't have something called financial implications. Mm. We must have gone to cabinet at the time and said, or even before, and made some projections. So it's a fuller report when I say to you, we had planned to roll out IFMS. The initial budget was so much. As at this point in time, when we went to cabinet to stop it, remember we said in our presentation that at some point we thought you can customize. It did not work. And when I was given that historical perspective, I said, those are some of the mistakes that we made. We rushed into something that we did not know. And we took a pause. We went to cabinet and said, it looks like we are failing in terms of what we said we are going to do. And by the way, we have spent so much at that point. Now allow us to move on a new system, on a court kind of package. The cabinet said yes, and that is what IFMS2 provided. Again, IFMS2 should have had a number that says there's a budget, and Treasury would have every year, in terms of what Parliament appropriates, would have said yes to, if you go to our own, what's our vote? Vote 10, vote 7. Vote 7. Vote 7 would have had a line somewhere that says allocations to National Treasury for IFMS is so much. Or in the past, again, it could have been, and colleagues in CETA can maybe recall, that IFMS was a project when you did not have the office of the CPO, you did not have the office of the Accountant General in its current form. If the Appropriations Committee and the Select Committee on Finance or Standing would come, they would explain and they would understand this. Reality is that spending, for instance, in IFMS was in CETA because we gave them an allocation. So allow us, Chair, with due respect and pleading with the committee, to say, I don't have that with me now in terms of what that number is in the CAP memo. I'll give you a number, someone will dispute it because someone will have that in their file.
No, so, let me roll here. You see, I think one of the things that might be happening with you is because you are now the new acting Director General of National Treasury. I think members, maybe they're trying to really ascertain, you know, they're weighing you. And they want to hear you. They want to hear whether you have the facts in your fingertips. That's on a lighter note. Honorable Dex.
Yeah, when you are finally accepted, give us the report on the costing, but also include it because we want to ask that when you bring the costing to us, procedures that was followed over this year, was procedures followed. We want to see whether those procedures was followed and stuff like that, right?
And we have our committee secretary here who is capturing this data, and he has Biela there, and we have Julius, who are also going to be assisting in actually formulating all the questions that we are asking, so that we get National Treasury to come back here. And I think you are off the hook. I'm glad they've said so. Why don't we proceed with you, Lini?
Thank you.
Am I calling you correctly? Lindsay?
Yes, Lindy.
Oh, Lindy, that's fine. Okay, Lindy. Okay, Lindy.
Oh, Lindy, where is my...
Okay, Lindy.
I'd like to, you know, kind of respond in a narrative and hopefully address everything, but start off with the procurement process that was followed and talk about Oracle specifically, because I think that's quite important to clarify. When we went to cabinet and we told them that we want to change direction, it was based on three essential studies that was done. First of all, we asked the World Bank, come and have a look, tell us what's happening in the world, have a look at what we have done and give us advice. So we got advice from the World Bank. We spoke to Gartner, that's an IT research company, and we got their views on, well, who are the role players? So if we want a new off-the-shelf system, who are the role players out there? And they gave us their magic quadrant that kind of gives you an indication of who these role players are. We also got a view from Ernst & Young that gave us a view on the architecture environment and whether or not you know, what the projection should be, and you know, development versus costs and bespoke type of solution. So we had an informed.
No. You can proceed, but I am telling you because you may feel intimidated. You see, Honorable Death, each time you mention IMS, you say, oh. Then you say, well, saying, you say, oh. Then you say, NSN Young, you say, oh. You know.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
But the reality, I think, as members, there's also a reality that we'll have to understand. Unfortunately, in the ICT space, we're not talking here about just software. We're talking about even operating systems. They're not very many well-established companies or even black companies in that space. We've got to be realistic as well. Or it's almost impossible to speak at our level without making reference to Oracle. So I'm saying we have to be mindful of those challenges that are not necessarily the design of our own technocrats necessarily.
So the idea behind that explanation was to say we tried to get together enough information to give cabinet sufficient to make an informed decision. We did speak to other companies and we had a look at other countries and what they have been doing. We then said to cabinet we would want a tier one solution. Now that's just based on the type of technology we want, the type of functionality we want, and what we felt based on all the research conducted would be something that would be sustainable within our environment. This went out on an open tender. Anyone could bid for this work. We specified the type of solution we wanted. It had to be a cost solution. It had to be from a tier one supplier. And we followed the process, which was managed by CETA. We had our own oversight over the process. And eventually, through that process, it was awarded to Oracle. We signed the contract with Oracle South Africa. Now, yes, it is a U.S. solution. They have provided us with software licenses, and we have signed up for them to give us design assurance, which means that they will have a look at what we're doing and advise us on, yes, this is what the solution can do, no, don't change it this way, because we want to make sure that we don't mess too much with the coding so that going forward it still can be upgraded without any issues. Oracle will not play a role, Oracle South Africa, Oracle Corporation will not play a role in the implementation of the solution. We want them as an assurance provider, they do not play a role in the implementation of it. They also do not contractually have access to the information. They cannot access our information. They cannot access our systems. There are specific contractual clauses in our agreement with them in that regard. The solution, all we bought is the software licenses. It will be housed with CETA in the private cloud. And what we've made clear to CETA, and obviously they would know that because it's legislated, this is government data. It has to be in South Africa. It cannot go anywhere else. And if someone has to work on the solution, they would have to come to South Africa and do any changes to it. There is no risk of our data leaving the country because legislatively it cannot, and that we leave with CETA to manage. In addition to that, there would be disaster recovery, but that the CETA CEO will mention. In terms of the security, part of the process was also to get certification from CETA that the solution we are providing meets a certain standard. There's an international standard to which they adhere to. I can't remember offhand what it is, but those verifications have done. So the solution is secure. It is up for us to make sure that wherever we put it, it also is protected from targets or physically and through cyber, I don't know, packing, etc. So that's what we have in terms of Oracle. We bought the licenses from them. It is a cost that is once off. There are no additional costs. So government departments will not be paying for the licenses. That has been paid for by government. There is an annual fee like any other maintenance fee that gets paid. And when we have completed and started rolling out, through our steering committee, we would agree on the cost recovery model and how that will roll out. So currently, departments are paying CETA for using BAS Logos Parcel. We will work with CETA to determine what is the costing structure and what are the user charges for departments once they come on board to the new solution and what costs they will pick up. At this point in time, departments will not be, there's no need to procure licenses because we bought, in terms of their matrices, we bought enterprise licenses, which should be sufficient for everybody. In terms of who will help us roll this out, so obviously, National Treasury is not an IT company. We will rely on CETA, and we will also then go to the market because and source capacity through that. Before we do that, we want to make sure that we understand the market players, and so we will be embarking on an exercise there. But they will be local companies that we will appoint to assist us with the implementation of the solution at CETA, at Treasury, at DPSA, and at the lead sites, because that is quite key for us in terms of our testing. We are mindful of using SMMEs and all other developmental objectives that we have in government currently. So those things are important for us, and that's why we want to understand who is there, what their roles are, what their expertise are, and what are the size of these different companies. So we want to use South African skills, and we want to use these individuals also to build South African skills. One thing I didn't mention, and you would have, it would have come out in the CETA presentation, is their center of excellence. So they will be developing capacity and bringing up skills that we can have locally that will support the solution. We don't want to buy something where we rely on a single vendor or we rely on someone internationally, because we want to have, this is our solution for the public sector, and we should be able to support it. And that's why it is a lot to do with people. It's a lot to do with the people that operate it. It's a lot to do with the organizations and the people that are going to maintain it. And these must be graduates that come through the system, SMMEs that will assist us. This is what we will be focusing on the way forward. Oracle is just playing an oversight role. They have done their job now. Now it's to look to the South African market to make it work. We do have, as I showed you, a PMO, and we do appoint consultants there. These are experts in terms of organizational change management. We would need quality management experts, and we would then get those if as and when we require them. We also look to CETA for technical services. So there are private companies that we will appoint to do that, to assist us in this regard. What we have made clear, however, is that if you are assisting us with PMO-type services, you limit yourself when it comes to implementation services. You can't be helping the project here and then also get involved downstream, and that's quite clear when we engage with the market. What is also very key for us, and that came up in a couple of questions, is the internal controls that must be built into the system. And we've started to develop a simple control framework. So what are the key things we want out of the system that we can start with in the blueprinting phase? So we want three-way matching, for example. And that's the type of things that we are trying to put in place and to identify. So we want documents to be scanned. We want to be able to keep them electronically. We want to make sure that there's segregation of duties. So we want to build or identify specifically now what are those key internal controls we want in place to ensure that information is appropriately stored and that, we limit ourselves to any fraud or misuse of the system. So that's important for us, and that will help us with our risk management. And there's a specific module that we have procured that will monitor, that will actually ensure or that this gets done. So again, we have, and we are thinking about the element of disaster recovery that will be stored within the system, but we've actually just recently had a discussion with CISA to talk about that and the location, et cetera. But I don't want to steal his thunder because I'm not an IT person specifically. So in terms of the when we do a broader rollout, so the broader rollout, because it's on a cloud, all you'll do is access it. The big activities when we do come to provinces and departments is cleaning up your data. And that is the department's responsibility, and this is what we need to stress. This gives us an opportunity to look at our data, to look at our suppliers, look at our employees, and clean that up and make sure that when we move this all onto the new solution, our data is accurate, complete, verifiable, etc. And that is the big process that will happen in the provinces. There won't be a lot to do around the technology, but it's about putting the data, cleaning up the data, transferring the historical data, and then the training. We have bought, it's almost like an e-learning platform, so we will be using that to deploy within the provinces and with departments. That is quite a hands-on module that will explain how the solution will work, what you will have to do. I think we also have to acknowledge, though, that this solution is going to, well, this initiative is going to do a lot more than just training individuals on using a system. We are going to give them basic accounting training and basic HR management training. So we can say that a lot of the cost attributable to this is actually financial management improvement cost as well. And we're using this as a good opportunity to say, let's do more sophisticated ways of doing our APPs, our strategic document, and a lot of training will go to that as well. And that also gives us an opportunity to upskill individuals, to redeploy them, and to give them possibility to focus on other issues. So instead of I'm stamping documents, I'm now doing analytics on documents for information and following up and focusing more on my controls. So we certainly want to try and redeploy and upskill staff as much as possible through this implementation phase. In terms of champions, what we said up front, stakeholder buy-in is very important. We did embark last year, or the year before, we embarked on a roadshow and we went to speak to all the heads of departments, the MECs. I think it's an opportunity for us to do that again. It is important for us to give high-level buy-in. We are, as I mentioned earlier, speaking to policy owners because that's critical. It's not just speaking to the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape, speaking to everyone to make sure that we address their requirements. But it is something that we did take to our recent steering committee to get guidance and say, well, how are we going to deal with ministers and the expectation gap that this program has, the expectation of this program on the public sector. In terms of, pension payouts and central control location of documents, I think we do, as I mentioned, we do want to have storage of documentation. Obviously, it's for the departments to ensure that they do that, and we want to give them enable them to have real-time information so that as soon as someone does give an indication of retirement, the processes within the system can already start, because at this point in time, there's so many manual documents that have to be completed and they get delayed in capturing. So we want to give them an environment in which there can be a shortened time between I've notified my department of resignation, now it means I need to get my pension payout, I need to get my housing allowance that has been saved up, etc. So we are working on empowering or enabling departments to have that functionality going forward. I think that covers most of the business stuff I think I'll hand over to Peter for if
it's... Thank you very much, honorable members. Chairperson, I think the sentiment that's coming out reflects a rather painful reality of where we are almost 2 decades after the creation of CETA, and a reality that we will never get out of until and unless we have dealt with the issue of skill. And I would like to start there. Because what the chairperson is talking about is an inspired world of imagination, where you see not only you are very, very sensitive to the context that you live in, but you are also inspired in terms of your ability to generate solutions. And I'll give you an example of how we are trying to take this CETA into that world around skills, and I'll do 2 examples. At the end of these examples, I hope that you'll appreciate that we probably have our finger on the pulse of the problem. However, that we have a journey. There's a journey in front of us. But the call for us to do something in the short term is there, and there are practical ways that we are dealing with the issues facing us right now. But the sustainable model is the one where we are able to generate the right skills. So last year, just before December, you know, just imagine the world of IT that the chairperson painted out there that produces these types of devices all the time. Yesterday I learned that the person who produced the Android operating system that is in the Samsungs, after it was bought by Google, he left, and yesterday he launched his own new phone, company called Essential. So we're talking about people who can do that in the context of their society and the society that they live in. So last year, just before the holidays, I sent out a message to the CETA team and said, go out and look wherever you're going to spend your holidays, look around yourself, remind yourselves of the social and economic problems of your environment, come back in January, and I give them a deadline, and tell me how you would solve those problems using IT. And I said, that option is available to anybody and everybody. And it is not through the line management, it's not through an APP, it's through your own awareness of your environment and through your own inspiration on how you can solve those problems. Because we all have opinions about how we solve our socioeconomic problems. But I'm giving you an opportunity to bring them to work. Then I reminded them that in our world, there is a corner there of people that, unfortunately, are called hackers. But they generate, that's how where innovation comes from. And around the world, you have these hackathons that happen. It's almost like you just walk in and you see strangers there, and you have a PC, and you just code away a solution. So I said, that's where we're going. I want hackers. Came back, and there were proposals on the table. Then we took them through training. We got companies. We said, whoever company you want to come and work with us, I'm not paying you anything. Bring your skills, but you must be inspired the way we are. And I don't owe you anything. So they came in, and we trained our people into in business, how to generate business value proposition, how to take these ideas and generate and create, you know, the normal value proposition. And they went through the training. And we judged them. We put them into groups. And then we took them into further training on coding. In April, we put them in a place the whole weekend. And for 48 hours, we said, sleep if you want to sleep. But we'll all be there to support you in the technical part of the hackathon. And they did. They worked. And out of that group, only about 20% of them were technical people, traditional. The rest, they were software developers. And I'm going to do two stories as an outcome of that. Tandi is based here in Cape Town. She's from Bloemfontein. And all she does here and what she's been doing over the last couple of years is to manage the LAN and the desktop environment in SAPS. She's been urging to go back home, and she was on her way out of CETA and probably out of public service. She was part of a team that hacked and developed on their own a solution that is at the heart of a predictive conscious and caring government. The government that anticipate based on its intimate knowledge of you what you need in your next step of life. So the application said that at the end, after you turn 18, these are the things that the government can do for you on their own. That team of four had never done software development officially at CETA. They modeled an environment where there is integrated data from basic education, basic education, from your aspirations, assessing and analyzing data that has come through, not only just the matric results, but perhaps even the ANA, saying to you, this is what you can do for Department of Transport. This is the GIS map of where you are. This is where you can get your further education training based on your profile. This is what sponsorships are available from the private sector for this this course of life that you want to go to. And this is the sponsorship that you can get from the public sector. Now, these are four people who have been with CETA for about 5 years minimum, who were challenged, who volunteered, and who spent 48 hours at a minimum. And I saw them because I was there with them the entire weekend, coding away and giving a solution to a problem that the chairperson just raised now. So Tandi is going back home in July. And she's going to anchor the new development, software development center of excellence in the Free State. What she's going to meet there is something else that we're doing for the province, where at least in five schools, and this is the beginning of a project, five schools in each of the five districts, the MEC has given us the schools of education. And we said it's in celebration of being number one in matric. The MEC has given us five. We're going to put, instead of a normal IT lab where we put computers and people Google, we're going to put software development tools. And we're going to provide all the software. It will all be open source. And we'll provide you with training. You will develop the things, we'll train you on the back of or in front of our e-government systems. You have a job. Afterwards, whether you want to be like others around the world, that we will certify you. You will be ready when we are done with you to be an independent innovator, to start your own company if you don't want to go to higher education. We will sponsor you if you want to go into higher education and training. We will give you an internship if you during your breaks. We will guarantee you a job afterwards. All we want from you is to accept, to pass our software development course, which has nothing to do with your normal curriculum. You do it on your spare time. You do it on your weekends. And accept that at the end, you are going to be conscientized to public service. That you are going to be a nerd like all the others around the world, who is going to work to innovate and provide solutions in public service. That's all we want from you. We'll work with you. So Tandi is leaving Cape Town on the 1st of July to go to Free State and start that project. This program is not driven from anything except for an understanding of how this system works and how to create that kind of inspired world that the chairperson and the members are talking about. Tandi is here because she volunteered. She went home and figured out, what can I do for my people? And came back. Pumuzo, the same thing. She was 5 days away from leaving Sita, because when she's working, she's just pushing paper as a business analyst. She was in a team of two, Pumuzo and Patience. And they said they saw them cry when their system was not working on the Saturday night. They came third. Tandi's team came second. I sat with Pumuzo direct. I said, why are you going to CSIR? What are you going to do there? He says, I'm going to be an architect. He said, Pumuzo, stay here and solve problems. We've taught you how to solve problems. Pumuzo said, I'm not going to CSIR. I want to do this thing, this new thing. We're generating those people. But for us to create the critical mass of people, to have a system self-generate, not only within CETA but outside of CETA, is, I think we can appreciate that it will take long. But it's not too far. It needs inspired leadership. It needs all of us here to support such initiatives. It needs us to deal with a bit of a cancer that is there in our system. A cancer that, no matter what you say, you can put a document. Right now, there's some members of our teams. Fortunately, I mean, this is a public forum. Every day, there are two cases that we're dealing with today, which reflect this cancer. Where somebody will say, I know that's a good thing, but I don't want a good thing. Then they will say, 5 years ago, CETA disappointed me. But today, there is no reason why. You cannot argue that we have not de-risked your program. You cannot argue that there is a reason for you to pay 30% premium on what we are giving to you. But then you say it's CETA's problem. We deal with that every day. But it's our job to convince people like that. Sometimes we don't have the right motive for that this is the right path to take. Today, we are looking at a supplier in the eye and we are not blinking, who has been with us for at least 18 years, who says that this is my contract even before we sign a renewal, who says that I will charge you whatever I want, and we said, no, you are not. And today we are staring at that person. And who says that I'm going to pull the plug? I said, you pull it, because you are proving our point. You are proving our point that when we tell you that we are going to look, we're no longer going to take an automatic 3-year contract with you. We're going to take a 1 year, and we won that prize that you quoted for 1 year. And then he comes and says, no, I'll double the prize the overall, the 1 year prize will double it to you if you only offer us a 1 year contract. I said, no, I know how this thing is done. 1 year for that price. Says they'll pull the plug. The only reason why they're fighting us is because we said this contract does not belong to you. If it's so specialized, then we must transfer the IP into government, into the state. So we are going to assess the opportunity for us to do it ourselves. And they don't like us. They hate us for that. And they threaten us. So as we are developing the likes of Tandi and Pumuzo and the rest of them, there are many of them out there, we deal with that external world, and we deal with the counterparts of that external world inside of CETA. Because it's not all Tandis and Pumuzos inside of CETA. There are people that have been there for a while,
that have benefited from a stale system. That's a world that is reflected in the anxiety and the anger and the frustration that is demonstrated here today and that we feel as we go through different portfolio committees. So in Gauteng, by way of example, we talk about integrated data and localizing these concepts. There is, yet we have not done it, we are developing, there are two projects that we have been assisting with. We are assisting every year with stabilizing that application system there, every year. It's not developed by us, but we always assist. But also, we have been asked, and we're developing this thing, which is an early childhood development program. Chairperson, I just want to give you an example of what that thing is going to deliver. My child, I have a benefit that they can go to private school, and I can afford that. But when they come in there, the registration day, I can give them some information, those people. On the first day, when my children come, that school knows what it needs in order to support my children at an individual level. But the child that goes into a public school does not have that benefit. When they come in on that first day, we don't know what is their medical history from inoculations. We don't know where they stayed. We don't know whether 3 years ago there was a flood or there was an outbreak of a disease there. We don't know how much transportation support in terms of transportation they need. If we had done that, as we got their information through a similar system like GDE. Remember, the GDE system says, I know upfront who is likely to come to this school. And I know it probably 6 months before. Today we know. It's May now. 6 months before. Imagine that between now and January, we now link them. We now link them to their provincial healthcare systems, public health systems, not only in the province of Gauteng, but in the province wherever they would have been. We link them to their home affairs data. We link them to the social data that is in SOCPEN and other social development support systems. We link them to the data about their guardians. How many of them have guardians or parents that are in the correctional services department? We link them to the housing or the human settlement, that information about human settlement, so that when they come, we know how to support them. Because we know that in that first year, the first 2 years of basic education, there's still an opportunity to put interventions. And we can put those interventions in context. Then we don't have 60% of them that fall through or that are not sitting at the exam center 12 years later. We can continuously decrease that percentage. That's integrated data. That is a system that we are building for department in Gauteng. That is something that was established in a 50-minute discussion between myself and the HOD of the department of the new e-government department in Gauteng. When we are done with that, it's a provincial system. It will have allowed us to even go into municipal systems. The Gauteng province is going to help us with that. When we are done with that, it becomes a provincial system. When we are done with that, it becomes a national system. So when we are done with that, we have integrated systems and data of not only departments across functions, but also the national, provincial, and local governments. We are launching that soon, Chairperson. I'd like to paint that and saying that we are in the middle of a journey. What I'm talking about here, you have not heard it before from a sitter. The danger, of course, of me sitting here is to paint a picture that does not seem to acknowledge the present and the past. I go through that every day. When we could not produce certificates, I ran that project directly. We got the other promoters. We got Sepiso. We got Mildred to solve that problem of certificates. From 136,000 individuals affected to today, only 5. Today. And all in a matter of 1 year, something that we couldn't do for 5 years. We can generate that. We can be done. It is parts of what I'm talking about right now are reflected in the presentation that I just gave now. But one understands that you are looking and filling this presentation that we just did today
in the context of the past and the present. I hope that we, on reflection, you'll find that there is a future that we're painting. When it comes to issues of Microsoft and security and so on and so forth, there is an element there, answers on page 10. The one thing that where we talk about private, so this is a government private cloud. Private cloud. That is in control, that is controlled by government. There are certain data where we have not done classification of systems and so on and so forth, but we know that there's a large chunk of that that will be sitting in government-controlled data centers. We'll do classification, and there will be a general agreement of what can sit outside of government data centers to not be something that we decide on our own. But even when it sits there, it still sits on a private system, on private systems that don't share with anybody. We are under pressure from global cloud providers to say, use public clouds out there. So that's a diagram on the bottom right corner of page 10, where people are saying, go and use international global public clouds. We said, we have drawn a line there. We said, we are not even dreaming of moving any of those systems outside of the borders. We still have not even authorized anybody to do local public cloud. So we are, all of it is under control. And disaster recovery is inherent in all of that. Business continuity of government is also inherent in all of that. But we are only at the beginning. Thank you very much, Chairperson and members.
Okay, members, we have a list of questions here that our researchers have to put together. What we are going to do, we are going to be forwarding them to you and would like the written responses. And those written responses, National Treasury, are going to be very important. Just on our side, before we close the meeting today, we wanted to thank you, but we also would like DPSA, DPME, National Treasury, and CETA maybe to find space to work around these issues that we are talking about. Maybe late in the year, we would like to get a report from you, because we really, really think that we can change the customer experience. By customer experience, we're talking about the citizens of South Africa, how they receive our services as government through the ICT platform. This is the way. We can no longer run away from that, and we are engaging with you. I need to state this. I need to emphasize it. We engage with you on this particular issue of ICT because we have observed that there are many risks, and as a committee, we also feel strongly that if we really want all the things that are promised in Chapter 10 to happen, we are not going to have that without getting the ICT, without attending to those issues of ICT. And we acknowledge the history that you've given us, Acting DG, National Treasury. It's very important because sometimes we forget where we come from, and we tend to think that, you know, everything is going to be happening. But unfortunately, the time is not in our favor. Things are moving at a much faster pace than we anticipated. So we need to find a way of also catching up with the way things are moving. So we will expect that written response from you, but we thank you very much, and we are hoping that we are going to be, because we need to start doing a countdown on how, whether we are really migrating properly and whether we are beginning to eliminate some of all these problems that have been there previously. And the turnaround time is a main concern to us, because things, they go, you go to cabinet, and somehow things just die out because we also don't perform our own oversight. So we can promise you that we are going to be holding you accountable. But with that, I'm hoping that, guys, if you could ensure that you forwarded the questions and to them so that we can get the same responses. But thank you very much. We are very encouraged by the stories that you are giving us. And please, we will have our support, especially at CETA, because CETA has to be central in this thing. There has been a lot of weaknesses, but I'm encouraged by your responses. Thank you very much, members. Yes.
There's a question that I would like.
I would like to add one question, please, so that they can respond if they are going to give us some answers. On the question of procurement of Oracle, Linda has explained how it went about.
Mm.
So some of the explanations that he gave, if you have some questions, you would. They bought a shelf company. One is interested in knowing how much you pay this government for a shelf company. And my understanding is that if it is a shelf company, then it still owns the solution. But I'm not saying they should answer now. And if they own the solution, then there should be premiums that we are paying for that. So I would like them to answer such questions and also add to about the validity of the licenses, the lifespan of the licenses that we have. I would like to hear more about that. Just for the sake of clarity, she can just push it inside.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ndombela. If you could put a lot of details, and even in the issues that you think we did not get them right, just clarify them. In writing, it's always better if we get that before you come to our meeting. And we really, really, really wanted to get those answers. And I'm not sure. Che, you wanted to say something?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I just wanted to steal one moment. I thought there was enough time. There were quite a number of things I wanted to respond to, but the one which I will ask, because I'm a bit of a Dallas talk, is he was my ex-colleague many, many moons ago, and I've been around for a while, is the, and having coordinated 17 government departments in ensuring that we successfully launched the World Cup. And what was very important is that the central direction in other countries, a project of this nature is driven from the presidency to ensure that we eliminate the delinquency that is there within the government departments. Because every time there's a new CIO, they look at SICTA purely as a procurement agency and they want to procure. And hence you find that there's a plethora of all of them in and around, and we cannot be able to be in a position, some of the systems are not even able to talk to one another, and therefore that delays our ability. And secondly, if we can learn, perhaps as a country, to separate the government from the state, because we seem to suffer. Because every time, one of the things we'll be able to achieve, some of the things we will be able to do, is because there's been a little bit of stability within the organization. Because without stability, you are unable to deliver, and that's going to be very important. If we can just separate the state from government, so that the state permanently resides, is there in ensuring that it's in a position to deliver. So if you can assist us, yes.
You shouldn't worry. We actually spoke about this thing because we're worried about the turnaround of the skills in government, and somehow we went and adopted the private sector models. And as a result, we treat the state as government. We come and go. We can be here today, tomorrow we may be voted out, or maybe even next year I may not be around. But the state must remain, and that's what we need to start instilling in the public service and administration environment, that they need to separate these two, because there has been a tendency of reducing the state to the level of government, and yet you are supposed to be operating at a level of the state and not necessarily government. I know this may sound complex, but it's very important as we stabilize as a country. It may have been necessary when we first came in as government, and that is why I'm actually happy that you've been there since 1998, because that's what we need to be having in the state. It's not good for the state to keep on having new people all the time. You have people coming there for 2 years, the following year they are gone, and you have to start all over again. We need to be keeping the skills, and that's when we start. The point we are making is very, very critical. But thank you very much. We appreciate your time, and we would like to get you those responses. We will give you the timelines as well as to when we will be we will be expecting you to respond. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. Oh,
Yeah.